Tonight we're going to pick up our study of the Old Testament survey by continuing where we left off. Last time we were in the Old Testament, we brought to the end the United Kingdom. We brought to the end of the united reign of the three kings that were part of the United Kingdom, that is Saul, David, and Solomon. But after the kingdom of Solomon, and Solomon dies, then the kingdom will divide, and the division of the kingdoms will lead to the fall of Israel. And we'll explain that in just a moment, because we're going to see that from this time forward, there are going to be two nations and not one. And so when we talk about Israel, we're not talking about the entire nation of Israel, we're talking about a portion of it. And we'll talk about that in just a few moments. But as we begin to look at this, I want to remind you again of what we have learned. We have learned that God warned them. God warned them in the very beginning when they decided that they needed a king, that the king would lead them to many problems. And he told them that they would become very rich, very prosperous, and the prosperity would come at the hands of Israel's own people. And that indeed happened. And that especially happened under the reign of Solomon. And that really set the table for what happened following his death. But prior to his death, Jeroboam was told that there was going to be a division, and that he was going to get part of that division. When Solomon dies, his son Rehoboam becomes heir to the throne of Israel. And as has been the practice, when the father dies, he chooses a son to take his place to be the rightful heir. That fell to Rehoboam. But we find out that the elders petitioned the young king to lighten the people's tax burden. He came to them and he asked them, "What do you think I should do?" Now there's some wisdom that the young king came to the elders and he asked them for advice. He asked them, "What do you think I should do? How do you think I should proceed?" And he told them that his father had made their burden very heavy, and that if he wanted to have success, then he needed to lighten the burden. And so he listened to that, but then he rejected that advice, and he accepted the advice of his younger advisors. He went to those of his own peer group. He went to those that he had grew up with, those who were young. Younger in years, and he sought their counsel. He sought their advice. And they told him to increase the burden. Make it even stricter. Make it even heavier than what your father did. And so in 3 days, he told them to come back and he would give them their answer of what he had determined to do. And so he rejected the advice of the elders. And he went along with the advice of the younger counselors and the younger advisors, and he increased their burden. He told them that he was going to make it very grievous. Now, what was their reaction to his decision? The kingdom divided, and the kingdom divided into two. The kingdom divided with 10 tribes that would make up the north, and they would be under Jeroboam. And 2 tribes would be known as Judah, and they were Judah and Benjamin. And they would be under the south, and they would be under Rehoboam. Now I want you to understand that the 10 tribes make up Israel, and 2 tribes make up Judah. And I want you to notice that these two kings, Jeroboam and Rehoboam, are not brothers. These are not both sons of Solomon. Only Rehoboam is the son of Solomon. Jeroboam is what we might call a military man. He is one that was in the military arrangement under the nation of Israel. But he was prophesied that he would receive 10 of the tribes, and that indeed happens when the kingdom divides. And then we begin to see that the kings of Israel will be different under 2 different rules. It begins with Jeroboam, and he rules for 22 years. He is fathered by Nadab, who follows for 2 years. His reign is not very long. It's very tumultuous in his reign. And then Baasha reigns for a period of 24 years. And then Eli comes in and he reigns for 2 years. These are the first kings of the northern kingdom. You need to remember something about the northern kings. The northern kings were very wicked. They were very much against the law of God. They became more wicked as they went along, but the difference was that Judah had some good kings. And while Jeroboam was reigning in Israel, in Judah, Rehoboam reigned for a period of 17 years. He was followed by Abijam, and he reigned for a period of 3 years. And then you had Asa, who reigned for 41 years. Now, Asa was a very good king. He had some early problems, but then he made some reformation. And so, for the most part, and we're talking generally, the kings of the north were evil, and the kings of the southern kingdom were the better king. That wasn't always true, but for the most part it was true. Now follow him with Zimri. Zimri didn't last very long. He only lasted 7 days, and he took his own life, and he brought the citadel, he brought it on top of himself and his home, and he only reigned for 7 days. He was followed by Tibni, and he reigned for 4 to 5 years. And then Omri. Now Omri is an important king, because he begins a dynasty reign. And Omri becomes the beginning of a very evil dynasty in the north. He is followed by a man you know very well. His name is Ahab. Ahab becomes the king of the north, and he is king for 22 years. Now, on the other side, Jehoshaphat is king for 25 years, and then he is followed by Jehoram. Now, one of the things I want to point out about these names, sometimes they are said differently. Sometimes you have the same name for the same king, but the king is different under a different nation. Even though they have the same name, it's not the same king. You've got to look at the context, whether it's talking about Judah or whether it's talking about Israel. Jehoram is also going to be a king in the north. And so there are two kings with the same name. That's very confusing sometimes, but all you have to do is look at the text. Ahaziah follows, and he only reigns for 1 year. And then he is followed by the only woman that reigns, Athaliah. She reigned for a period of 6 years. Now, she's an interesting reign. She killed every one of her grandsons. You think about this. Here is a grandmother that kills every one of her grandsons to make sure that there is no threat to her authority to gain the throne. She takes it by scheming and maneuvering, and she makes herself queen, and she rules for a period of 6 years. And during her reign, there is much political chaos during those 6 years. But now, that is followed by Ahaz for 2 years, and then Jehoram. Now this is a different one. This is not the same one we just looked at. This is a different one. And then we have Jehu, and then we have Jehoash. Now, let me ask you something. Why, what common thread did the kings of the north have? The common thread for the kings of the north was Baal worship. It was introduced by Ahab and Jezebel, and it began to permeate all the way through the rest of the northern kingdom. And then Joash, Maaz, Azariah, and Uzziah reigned in Judah. Now, then we won't go through all of these kings, but I want you to notice that now the reigns begin to be shorter in the north. Notice, after Jeroboam II, 41 years, Zechariah only does 6 months, and Shalem only does 1 month. Why? There's political chaos. And how does the reign end? It ends in assassination. These later kings in the northern kingdom, they end in assassination. There's chaos, there's corruption, there's greed. It permeates all through the north. Jotham, Ahaz, and that will continue into the next lesson when we get into the divided kingdom. That brings us to the last kings of Israel. The last kings of Israel, Mahan, Pekahiah, Pekah, and Hoshea. Now, how long did the kings reign in the north? 205 years. From the time that the kingdom divided until it was taken into Assyrian captivity was a period of 205 years. They had 205 years. They had approximately 16 kings, and the overall majority of those kings were evil and led them into paganism, idolatry, heathenism, and led them into being spiritually rebellious against God. And because of their sin, they would be led off in Assyria captivity in 722 B.C. But when Israel falls in 722, that's just the 10 tribes. That's not Judah. Judah will continue in the next lesson. Judah is going to last by herself for 135 more years. She will have 135 years that she will reign separate and apart while Israel is in captivity in Assyria. But what I want you to see is we want to talk about how did it get here? How did we get to the fall? How did things go bad so quickly? And you think, well, 205 years isn't quickly. Oh, it is quickly. It happened very quickly because they forgot God and they forgot the law. Now, when the kingdom divided, what happened? Well, it kind of happened what happened in the north and the south in our country in the 1860s. We have what we call civil war. That's exactly what they had in Israel. Israel and Judah were fighting against one another. Jeroboam and the 10 tribes fought against Rehoboam and the 2 tribes, and those fights lasted for the first 50 years of the time of the northern kingdom. That civil war lasted for a period of 50 years. And if you study that period, every time one person gets an advantage and then the other nation gets an advantage, and it just goes back and forth for a period of 50 years. Shortly after taking office, Jeroboam decides that he's going to change the worship. And when he changes the worship, he introduced 2 calves to worship. He sets one up in Dan, and he sets the other in Bethel. What was his mindset? Why did he do that? You see, he was afraid that those that were in Israel, that they would go down to Jerusalem and they would worship God on the appointed feast day. And they would go down there and they would remember their responsibilities to do the temple worship. And so to prevent them from going down and maybe staying there and not coming back, he set up their worship in Bethel and in Dan. And what was his reasoning? I want you to take your Bibles out, and I want you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 16. Excuse me, chapter 12. Chapter 12, and I want you to look at verse 27. Look at verse 27 of 1 Kings chapter 12. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will return to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So what was his big problem? What was Jeroboam really worried about? He was worried about his position. He was worried about his power. He really wasn't worried about the people. He was worried about losing his authority. He was worried about losing the nation. And so he had a plan. In verse 28, so the king consulted and made 2 golden calves. And he said to them, it is too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Israel. Have you heard that before? Do you remember the golden calf in Exodus chapter 32? That was made while Moses was up getting the law on Mount Sinai. And remember, we don't know what happened to Moses. Make us gods to go before us. And remember, he fashioned that golden calf. He says, look, here's the God that led you out of Egypt. But I want you to notice what this led to. Now look at verse 31. Excuse me, verse 30. And now this thing, look, became a sin, for the people went to worship before one as far as Dan. This became a sin to the people. And every northern king following Jeroboam fell into the trap of paganism and heathenism, idolatry. This set in motion. You know what this is an example of? Convenient religion. Oh, it's too far. You're not going to make that trip down to Jerusalem. That's a hard trip. You go down there with your children, your animals. Why? You don't go need to do that. You just worship right here. We're going to make it convenient for you. There's only one little problem. That wasn't the place that God authorized or designated to worship. The house of God, where was it at? Where was the temple of the Lord at? It was in Jerusalem. That's where they were to worship. That was where they were to pay respect and homage. And Jeroboam knew that. And so he set up something that would eventually... This was the beginning of the end of the northern kingdom. The very first decision they make will lead to their eventual downfall, because it will set in motion idolatry. The kings who followed did not stop at the departure from God's law. So the apostasy just continued. It began with the idols, but then it permeated through a lot of other different things. During Rehoboam's reign in Judah, the Egyptian Pharaoh sacked the temple. They sacked it and took some of the articles that were in the temple, and they took them away. And then the northern kings became progressively more evil. After Rehoboam, every king save one became more evil. And what was happening? They were getting farther and farther and farther away from God. That brings us to Ahab and Jezebel. They sealed the deal. When Ahab and Jezebel came on the scene, they really put the nail in the coffin of the northern kingdoms. You remember what I told you about Omri? Remember the dynasty? Ahab is part of this dynasty. Now, Ahab married the daughter of the king of Sidon, and her name was Jezebel. Now, Jezebel introduced Baal worship to Israel. Not only did she introduce it, she tried to change all religion in Israel to Baal worship. She tried to replace it. She tried to replace the true worship of God with Baal worship. Jezebel thought to stamp out the Jewish religion in Israel. How did she determine to do that? She killed the prophets. She put a price on their head. They were on the run. They had to hide for their life, because she tried to take them out of the land. She tried to erase the true religion of God and replace it with Baal worship. She erected a Baal temple in Samaria and began to put God's prophets to death. Elijah prophesied that there would be a 3-year drought where no rain would fall in the land. Now, what would that bring? That would bring economic hardship. That would kill their crops. That would kill their cattle. It would cause problems for their family. All of it was a direct link to the Baal worship. All of it was done as punishment. God is chastising His people because they are practicing idolatry. And so, what is He doing? He's chastising them. He's punishing them to get them to come back to Him, to get them to not follow Baal worship. God used the ravens and the widow to feed Elijah miraculously while he was on the run. Of course, who does Ahab and Jezebel blame? Well, they don't blame themselves. They blame Elijah. He came with the prophecy, so he's the culprit, the messenger. He's the one that caused the problem, and so they seek his life. And he begins to run. And he begins to be on the run, and he's at one point he's in a cave, and he thinks he's all by himself. That everybody's been killed, and he's on the run, and they seek his life. You remember what God told him? What are you doing? Get out of the cave. Not everybody's caved into Baal. I've got 7,000 other men that haven't bowed their knee to Baal. You get out and you do my work. You don't worry about what Jezebel's doing. And so that leads us to Mount Carmel. Probably one of the greatest examples of the power of God is demonstrated on Mount Carmel. You see, Elijah calls all the prophets of Baal and God's people, a solemn assembly, to come to the top of Mount Carmel. And he calls them together to put an end to this discussion once and for all. Now Ahab, he accuses Elijah of troubling Israel. You remember Obadiah? Remember Obadiah was keeping the prophets and putting them, and then Ahab and Obadiah decide they go out to the land and they divide up and they look for water. And remember, who does Obadiah run into? Elijah. And he pays respect to Elijah. And Ahab, Elijah says to Obadiah, go and get your master. You remember what Obadiah said? Are you crazy? What have I done to you? Why do you want to kill me? He says, I know what will happen. I'll go and tell my master that I saw you, and then the Lord's Spirit will call you away, and you'll be gone, and then Ahab will know I had you in my hands, and I let you go, and he'll take my life. But you remember what Elijah told him? You go get him. I mean, I'll be right here. I got a message for him from God. And so, when Elijah comes to meet Ahab, what is his first words to Elijah? Oh, thou troubler of Israel. You're the one that's caused this problem. You're the one that brought this drought. You're the one that's caused all this problem in my kingdom. And do you remember the answer that Elijah gave him? Oh, no, Elijah. Elijah said, oh, no, it's not me. It's you, O king. You're the one that introduced Baal worship. You're the one that left the true worship of God. You're the one that brought this on. And now we're going to put an end to this once and for all. You bring all the prophets of Baal, 450 of them, you bring them up to the top of Mount Carmel, and you call the whole congregation of Israel and have them meet me up there. Now what's he going to do? Elijah suggests a test. He's going to suggest a test in order that we could determine who the true God is. You know what he says? He says, how long are you going to halt between two opinions? Look at the wisdom of Elijah. He says, if Baal is God, then you follow Baal. But if God is God, you follow Him. He said, you've got to make a decision. You've got to get off the fence. You've got to determine who you're going to follow. And so he says that he suggests a test. And what is the test? The 450 prophets of Baal against the one prophet of God. Now what's the test? The test is that we take two animals. We cut them up. We build an altar. We place them on the altar. But we set no fire underneath them. You call the Baal. I'll call the God. And whoever lights the sacrifice, let him be God. Remember what the people said about that? People said they didn't speak a word. They said that's good. And so they did the test. And Elijah called on God, and fire came from heaven. I love this picture. These are the prophets of Baal. They prophesied from morning till evening. They call on Baal. They plead with Baal. They beg Baal, and no answer. And then about midday, Elijah begins to mock them and said, maybe you need to scream louder. Maybe you need to wake him up. Maybe he's on a journey. Maybe he's asleep. And maybe you need to wake him up. And you remember what they did? They began to jump. They began to cut themselves with the lances. The blood flowed on the altar, but no fire, no answer. And that happened till evening. But you know what I remember about this story? He said that he did everything at the word of the Lord. And then Elijah said, it's my turn. He set up the altar, set the sacrifice, and then he commanded that they put a little trough around the sacrifice. And then he told them to pour 3 barrels of water on it, not once, not twice, but 3 times. So much water that it covered the wood, covered the sacrifices, and it filled up the trough around the altar. But then you know what he did? He called upon God and said, God, answer and show these people that thou art God. One time only, fire came from heaven, devoured the sacrifice, devoured the water. And if you were there, you got any problem understanding who God is? You got any understanding of who the true God is in this situation? You know what all the people said? We will serve God. Now let me ask you something. Wouldn't that make an impression on you? If you witnessed that test and you saw that the prophets of Baal were unable to do anything, and God in one prayer was able to do what these prophets couldn't do from morning till evening. But you know what God did? God not only lit the sacrifice, they killed every one of those prophets on the mountain. Well, who found out about that? Jezebel. She wasn't too happy about it either. Elijah kills the prophets of Baal. The rain begins to fall in Israel in Acts, in 1 Kings chapter 18. And then Jezebel places a price on Elijah's head. She said, you're going to be just like my prophets tomorrow. You know what that meant? Your life's not worth anything. I'm coming after you. And so he began to be on the run. God reminds Elijah he's not alone. Seven others have not bowed to Baal. And so he needs not to be afraid. And Jezebel then makes insult to injury. Ahab decides that he wants this vineyard that's next to his home. And he offers Naboth, he offers to buy it. Naboth's vineyard, he offers to buy it, but Naboth said, it's my inheritance. It's in my family. I can't sell it. It's part of my inheritance. And so you know what the old king does? He goes home and he pouts about it. And he looks dejected. And Jezebel sees him and says, what's the matter with you, Ahab? He says, I tried to buy Naboth's vineyard, but he wouldn't sell it to me. He says, are you not the king? He says, I'll take care of this. And so what she does, is she gets these scoundrels and she gets them to come and invite Naboth to a feast and then makes an accusation against him and then they kill him. And after they kill him, who can take possession of the vineyard? Ahab. But who meets him down there? Who meets him down there when he went to take possession of the vineyard? Elijah. And Elijah tells Ahab, and he foretells the death of Ahab and Jezebel, and at the end of Ahab's house. You know what he said? The blood that flows in this vineyard of Naboth, he said, your blood the dogs will lick up in this place. And that happened. That happened. Ahab's dynasty. Israel and Judah become allies to invade Syria. God is very angry at Judah for forming an alliance with Judah. Israel with forming an alliance with Judah. They begin intermarriage between Ahab's family and Judah, brings more wickedness into Judah. Jehoram, king of Judah, marries Jezebel's daughter. Now, if he married her daughter, what kind of religion do you think she brought in? She brought in Baal worship to Judah. Now you got Baal worship in Israel, and now you got it in Judah. And now you got it throughout the whole kingdom. He slew all the brothers who might have claim to his throne. 68 of them, put them to death. Only one got away. The nurse hid a young child named Josiah, hid him where he didn't find him. But all the others are killed. Can you imagine the dastardly of killing all your brothers just so somebody can't take the throne away from you? This is the kind of evil there was. Following Ahab's death, Ahasuerus is king. He lasted years, killed by Jehu during the overthrow of Ahab's dynasty. Ahasuerus' mother, Athaliah, daughter of King of Omri, killed all the heirs of the throne except Joash, who was an infant hidden by the priest. She killed every child that could lay heir to the throne. Everyone. What kind of woman would do such a thing? To her own grandchildren. You want to know how evil Israel was? You want to know how corrupt they became? How far are they away from God? How much evil will they do? The theory upshifted the authority. And she was the only person outside David lineage to occupy the throne in Judah. She is the only one. She has the distinction of being the only one outside the direct lineage of David to ever occupy the throne in Judah. She is the only one. Athaliah is going to pay for her evil with her life. Elisha prophesied during the reigns of all these kings and Joash in Judah. Now, he saw Elijah being taken up in a chariot of fire. Who took his place? Elisha. Elisha is given a double portion of his spirit, and he begins to be the new prophet. Elisha received a double portion of Elijah's spirit. He performed many miracles. He used a small amount of oil to pay the debt of a widow, and the oil never ran out. He raised a Shunammite woman's dead son. He made a poisoned portion of pottage non-toxic. He healed Naaman's leprosy. He smote a large band of soldiers with blindness that they could not come after the people of God. He also did another thing that I don't have up on this chart. He made an axe head float. All these were miracles that were done under the reign of Elisha. Now, while all this is going on in Israel, they're getting more wicked. They're getting farther away from God, and they're getting closer and closer to captivity. What is happening in Judah? What is happening in the same history with the sister nation? In Judah, the kingdoms continue to degenerate. King Azariah becomes an ardent worshiper of Edomite gods in 2 Chronicles chapter number 25 and verse 14. He begins to follow those Edomite gods and introduce them into Judah. Uzziah attempted to burn incense in the temple. Here's a king who is granted a victory over his enemies, and he goes into the temple and he decides to take it upon himself to burn incense because he's king. He is opposed by the 80 priests who stand in the temple and tell him to get out of here. You're not of the Levite tribe. It's not for you to burn incense. And you're violating the law of God. And he goes in there anyway. And as soon as he does, God strikes him with leprosy. And he dies a leper. You see, God gave him a great victory, but he let it go to his head. And he ended up violating God, and he ended up losing his kingship over it. Ahaz erects an altar in Jerusalem like the one built by the king of Assyria. He closed the doors of the temple so that none could worship there. Imagine that. Here is the prophet of God that's closing the temple so nobody can go there to worship. Now how pleased do you think God is about that? But in Judah, they had hope. Because after those two evil kings, then they had some good kings. Some kings that reformed things. Judah had seven righteous kings. King Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoash, Uzziah, and Jotham were considered good kings in Judah. They undertook reform. They reconformed temple worship. They took all the idols. They took them out. They destroyed them. The high places, the altars, all of them were removed. The influence of such men corrected many of the evils introduced by the evil kings and is the reason that Judah lasted 135 years after Israel goes into Assyria captivity. But the terrible condition in Israel continued. It just gets worse. Brief periods of glory during the reign of Jeroboam II. His son Zechariah reigned for only 6 months, being murdered by Shalem, who sought to usurp the throne. And then Shalem lasted 1 month before Menahem murdered him, and then he reigned for 10 years. And then Pekahiah lasted 2 years before Pekah murdered him. Do you see political assassination, one after the other? You know what it's becoming? It's becoming a corrupt system. It no longer resembles anything of God. It no longer resembles anything that God wanted or that God designed. And you know what? With the murder of Pekah, God has had enough. God has seen enough. And He's going to bring this story to an end. Assyria was a growing power, and Israel was divided over whether to pay her tribute. Only one of Israel's last six kings died of a natural cause. Only one. And he only lasted 2 years. Pekah reigned for 20 years in Israel, and he sought to stand and fight Assyria. He tried to oppose the great growing power of the north. Allied himself with Rezin, king of Syria, and forced Ahaz of Judah to help him. And then Assyria attacked Syria and crushed her and Israel. Hoshea formed a conspiracy, killed Pekah, and became king in his place. That was the last king of the divided kingdom of Israel. Hoshea was the last king. In a battle with Assyria, many Jews were taken captive. Hoshea is the final king. He reigned for a period of 9 years. During the first part of his reign, he paid tribute to Assyria. Why? So they would not take them over. So that they would not repress them. And then in the 6th year of his reign, he sought to form an alliance with Egypt to fight against Assyria. Question. Why didn't he go to God? Why did he seek Egypt out? Because God was no longer listening. Why? They left God. God left them. It's just that simple. Assyria besieged Samaria for 3 full years. Beginning in 719 B.C., and for the next 3 years, the city of Jerusalem was under siege. You know what that means? Nothing went in, nothing came out. Things got so bad that they were eating their own children in Jerusalem. And then they were finally carried away into Assyrian captivity in 722 B.C. Assyria carried the 10 northern tribes into captivity and brought others from various nations to occupy the land of Israel. What they did is they intermingled the blood. The blood of Israel, the Jewish lineage, they intermingled with other blood. It's where you get the Samaritan race. It's why there's so much hatred between the Samaritans and God's people. How did it get so bad? How did it end so terrible? A nation brought out of Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, a glorious kingdom. After they made the first mistake and finally went in and conquered the land, they got their inheritance. And now they're a mighty nation. God's with them. God is leading them. They have a 120-year period of prosperity in the United Kingdom. And then as soon as they divide, and the first decision that the king made that was not God's choosing led them into idolatry. And as Paul Harvey says, that's the rest of the story. Now, God sought to avoid captivity. God did everything He could to stop Israel from rejecting His law. How did He try to stop them? How did He try to stop them before it was too late? The prophets. He sent the writing prophets. He sent Isaiah, Hosea, Isaiah, Joel, Amos, Micah, as well as all other prophets. What was their message? It was a uniform message. Repent or face the wrath of God. Had they seen the wrath of God? You know they had. But you know what? They didn't care because they did not believe it. You know what they thought? They thought that because they were God's chosen people, that nothing evil could happen to them. You know what? That's the same thing Israel thinks today. They think that they have this special relationship with God and no evil can befall them because they are God's chosen people. That's exactly what they thought. Didn't work out that way, did it? You know what that is? It's a living testimony of Proverbs 14. Sin is a reproach to any nation. Underline that. Any nation. That includes ours. Sin will bring a nation to her knees. And it brought Israel to captivity in Assyria. Judah and Benjamin are now alone in Judah trying to remain faithful. Israel followed Moses' prediction. What did Moses predict before his death? In Deuteronomy 28 and 29. In his death, he predicted that when they got the land, they would forget about God. They would not study His law. They would not be faithful. They would go into idolatry. They would worship other gods. And what did Moses tell them that God would do? He will take you off of this good land, and He will allow your enemies to oppress you and destroy you. Did God keep His word? Yes, He did. The Assyria captivity marked the end of the national existence of Israel. Now, one closing thought. This captivity is much different than the one we will study about next, Judah. Because at the end of this captivity, there is no promise. Listen, there is no promise that a remnant will ever come out and be returned to their homeland. Remember what Assyria did to make sure that couldn't happen? Not only did he take them into captivity, he brought other people from other lands to intermix their races and their families so that they could never be what they were before. You know why that happened? Because God allowed it. That was part of their punishment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, do we learn anything from that? There's three things I want to close with tonight that I hope we can learn from the history of the nation of Israel. Number one, that we are free moral agents. And our relationship with God does not mean that we can't make foolish decisions. Just because we are in a covenant relationship with God does not take away our free will. Number two, that there is a time when God's patience will run out. God put up with it for 205 years. And then He said, that's it. And number three, and most importantly, that obedience and faithfulness is something that is not negotiable. If you want God's favor, if you want God's blessing, if you want Him to be with you and for you and protect you and be with you, one of the conditions is unwavering, unrelenting faithfulness and obedience to His law and His commands. And when that is not done, there is a consequence. Now, you know what we say in our time? You know what saying is very popular in our country today? We have a proverb too. It goes like this. Those who do not learn from the past mistakes of mistakes made in history are doomed to repeat them. Think about that. And then think about our nation. Think about what happens when a nation forgets God. Look at what direction. What's the only way you can go? When you take God out of the equation, what's left? It's a downward slide into destruction. And you know where Israel end up? Was inevitable. It is inevitable when you leave God, when you leave His law, when you go in your own way and you do things your own way, that it will always, always end up the same. You will be destroyed. And you know who will do it? Not God. We do it to ourselves. Didn't Israel do it to herself? Didn't she have ample warning? Didn't she have ample opportunity to turn it around? What did all those prophets say? Didn't all those prophets say, if you don't change, if you don't repent, doom is coming. God is going to judge this nation. And you're going into captivity and you're never coming out. They scoffed. They ridiculed. They mocked. They laughed. They thought it was a joke. They were wrong. I hope we don't make the same mistake. In Romans 15, verse 4, the Bible says, whatever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that through hope and comfort that we might have hope. Brethren, it never had to end like this. The great beginning could have continued if they would have just continued to follow God. And so if you're here tonight, and you're a Christian, and you take great pride in the fact that you have a relationship with Christ, that's good. That's wonderful, and I commend you for that. But don't rest on your laurels. Your work's not done. Until we get the last mile of the way, until we fulfill our race, till we finish our course, our work is not done. God has put us here for a reason, and the reason He put us here is to do His work and to do His bidding. And that work and that responsibility does not end until we draw our last breath or until the Lord comes again. And may we never get so complacent, and may we never get so arrogant to think that our covenant relationship with Christ puts us in a position that He's just going to overlook what we do because He loves us and He cares for us and He'll never let anything happen to us. We need to learn from the mistakes of the past. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, we want you to take this opportunity to render obedience to the gospel. It's not a physical birth, it's a spiritual birth. By hearing the word of God, believing it, repenting of your sin, confessing His good name before man, and submitting to the watery grave of baptism to contact the blood of Christ to put you into Christ, to put you in the kingdom of God, to make you a joint heir, to give you hope of everlasting life, and to wash away your sin, that you might stand sanctified, justified, and acquitted before God. That's God's hope. That's His mercy. That's His grace. And it's offered to all of mankind, and He can take advantage of it while He lives and while He breathes. But even when you do that, it's not a done deal. It's not written in stone. It doesn't mean it can never be lost. If you don't think it can be, go back and study what we just studied. These people were people of God. These people had a covenant relationship with God. And they lost their life, they lost their relationship, and they lost their relationship and everything that went with it. Did God quit loving them? No. They quit loving God. And when you quit loving God, you put Him in a position that there is only one thing He can do. Because He cannot have fellowship with sin. We have to get out of that, we have to repent, and we have to come back. And when we do that, He will accept us again. If they would have done that, if they would have listened to the prophets, would God have spared them? Of course. Why send them there if He was going to destroy them anyway? He gave them the chance, they rejected it, will you? If you're subject to the Lord's invitation, we bid you come forward together. We stand.